you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. What you're about to hear is the dramatic conclusion of Fortress Africa by Tristan Verboven. If you're not familiar with the Twilight Histories format, in these stories you are the adventurer, just like in a game book or role-playing campaign. You will travel to different dimensions and experience strange and exotic cultures that never existed in our timeline, all with you as the hero. In today's episode, you will continue your adventure in a world where Hitler died early. The great powers have come to an uneasy peace, and a new Cold War is descending into revolution. A quick shout-out to our latest patrons, Walter Zarins, Adam Flintstone, Trent, Tristan Hoffman, Anthony Monica, and Nigel Draper. I really believe that superb podcasters such as Tristan Verboven need to be paid for their hard work, and your patronage of the Twilight Histories makes that happen. I know this is a tough time. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and a recession may be around the corner. Now, more than ever, we need to support our podcasters so that they can keep their heads above water and keep their stories going. Let's get on with today's show. The conclusion of Fortress Africa by Tristan Verboven.
You are woken to the earthy smell of a canvas tent in the morning dew. The pre-dawn is a glowing ridge around where your shelter reaches the earth. The air is filled with a mixture of the fragrant desert grass and your snoring bunkmates. You realize that it is still 1965 and you are still a refugee in a camp in Libya. But this is no ordinary morning. Your eyes start to focus and you see army boots, khaki pants, and the muzzle of a Beretta assault rifle hanging by the side. You look up, and it's the two female soldiers that had accompanied the captain the day before. They are standing above you, and only you, motioning you to follow them. And you look over to Mohammed, who is already up, and you snap out of your dreamy haze. After clumsily gathering your belongings, you step out into the cool early light. Through the camp's stillness, you can hear a distant baby crying, and as you walk out, the guards salute the women casually. You look to them for answers, but they just nod their heads in direction of the back of a military jeep. Friendly, but still not a word. You start driving away from the coast back into the desert, first along a road, then break onto a dirt path until finally you're driving through open desert. You travel this whole time wondering, of course, how this drive into the desert is going to end. Mohammed does not appear fazed by this and seems to know what's going on. This, of course, offers no comfort. One of the women is sitting across from you with her rifle propped up between her knees, and she's peeling nuts between her fingers. Her comrade is standing next to her, holding the roll bar to keep steady, and you overhear the women speaking in Berber. "The sun will be up by the time we get there," says the one standing. "In a few hours it will be unbearable." "It's only a couple of kilometers across," says the other. "As long as the basin is dry." The one with the nuts looks over to Mohammed and offers some to him. He nods and she tosses him the bag. "She is Fatima," says the one standing, pointing to her partner. "And I am Marwa." She smiles to you. "We help you to find your stotsas," she laughs. "We are all fighting the imperialists." "You are comrades in this?" We are not communists, she says, shaking her head. But we help our African brothers and sisters. But don't you take your orders from Rome? You ask. Don't worry, she smiles. Soon there will be no Romans in Africa. Colonialism finished. She makes a macabre gesture with her gun. We do it the African way. She looks over to Mohammed, who just at that moment cracks one of the nuts between his fingers. There's an awkward silence. And before long, the jeep slows to a stop. The women jump out into the dirt and point towards the west.
That way, across the lake, there is Tunisia.
You look out into the horizon. The lake, as they call it, is a vast, salty expanse, parched under the hot sun, not a drop of water in sight. They hand you each a full canteen.
Allah protect you!
They get back into the jeep, and as they peel away, they cry,
Revolution!
You look over at Mohammed, who's far less distressed about this than you are. He's tying a scarf around his head and points to you to do the same. You are starting to feel the sun on the back of your neck as it creeps up behind you, sending a long shaft of shadow into the wasteland ahead of you. And you are on your way into the saltscape. The ground crunches under your feet like fresh snowfall as you leave your mark in the crystalline pools. Occasionally, your foot sinks into the murky patch of soft sand and Mohammed grabs you by the arm to keep you from tripping. From then on, you follow his steps and place your foot only where he has placed his. After about an hour, you reach the lowest point and you are now meandering along a narrow stretch of solid ground. You're growing tired in the hot sun, but your companion shows no sign of slowing down. Soon enough, you feel like you're climbing again, and slowly the far bank comes into view. Eventually, the crusty pools give way to rocky terra firma, and you are once again among familiar desert fauna and dust. Another kilometer in the distance, you can make out a vehicle parked seemingly in the middle of nowhere. Mohammed confidently makes his way straight for it, so you follow him. As you approach the vehicle, you see two figures in flowing Berber dress welcoming you with open arms. Mohammed shakes hands with them firmly and warmly as we arrive.
Welcome, my friend.
The man with a similar scarf wrapped around his head motions you to the back of his van.
We are waiting for you for a long time, he says. We see you have an accident, so we stay here. But we must hurry to Tunis to deliver a message.
You're given a long cloak to wear, with a hood to cover your head. Before long, you are traveling north towards the capital. You travel down a straight paved road for an hour through a featureless rocky landscape until you reach a small coastal town. All of the businesses are flying red flags and people are carrying red banners. You slow to stop at a checkpoint, where a man is waving his hand downward. His armed companions with heads wrapped in green and red scarves surround the car. One of the two men in the front seat nods his head to you.
Don't worry, mister. They are friends.
He rolls down the window and offers the man a pack of cigarettes. They talk quietly for a few minutes, and then another man approaches the car with an assault rifle over his shoulder. He speaks with a louder voice this time and continues around the car, peering into the window. He points to you and asks the driver a question in Berber. You cannot quite hear his response, although you can make out a single word.
Stotsas.
The men are satisfied with this and wave you through, and before long you are back on the highway. For the next 6 or 7 hours, the drive takes you farther and farther north. The men in the front talk and smoke a lot, stopping once more in a small fishing village of Shkira. There, too, large red flags and banners line the streets and sides of the road. Traffic slows down around a burning truck blocking the way. You notice a sign on the side of the road, Rommel Landwirtschaftliche Siedlung. It has been violently splashed with red paint. The sign indicates a smaller road leading to an enclosed settlement a kilometer from the road. In the distance, you can see another ominous billow of smoke coming from some of its buildings. At the sight of this, you cover your face and sink deep into the seat in the vehicle. You continue to drive until the harsh desert starts to give way to more fertile country, and buildings become more dense and checkpoints more frequent, and by nightfall you have arrived in the outskirts of Carthagische Schutzgebiete. You also notice more military vehicles and irregular gangs of men with red and green scarves and AK-47s hanging off their backs. As night begins to fall, you drive to a residential neighborhood near one of the city gates. You park the car and proceed on foot. Taking care to keep the hood of your coat over your face, you follow the men down the narrow streets to a large open square. You are at the edge of a vast no-man's land, lined with makeshift fortifications and sandbags, and behind each of the piles are men in irregular combat fatigues and headscarves, all holding AK-47 assault rifles. One of the men from the car waves you over to duck behind one of the piles of debris. He points through at an opening. "There is the entrance to a European sector," he says gravely. "We take foreigners here when we find them. We give them to the Germans so they can go home." You watch as a truck pulls up to the gate. Immediately, searchlights bear down on it from defensive towers. The driver exits with his hands up. He goes to the back of the truck and lets out the passengers in the single file and leads them to the gate. Some German guards approach the truck and guide the men and women through to a series of tank call traps and barbed wire to safety. He turns to you and Mohammed. "Are you ready?"
"You mean I'm going in there?" you ask.
"Of course, my friend," he laughs. "You must take Mohammed. He cannot speak. You must go to see Stotsas."
You look out again at the macabre fortification surrounding the gate, spotlight slowly creeping around the street along the sandbags. German soldiers have created a human shield around the people as they disembark. Their guns are trained on any sudden movement.
"It is safer for you in there, don't you think?" he says in a serious tone. "It is not safe for you out here, that is for sure."
Mohammed is all ready to go with his passport in hand, and he motions politely for you to go first. You throw off your Berber cloak and hood, take out your passport, and climb slowly over the barricades. Mohammed follows closely behind you. Holding your papers clearly over your head, you approach the gate. And as you take a few steps forward, two spotlights immediately find you.
"Halt!" screams a soldier. "Don't move! We're foreigners! Please, don't shoot! Get down on the ground!"
A small group of them detach from the others to check your papers. He flips through your passport as you lie there on the pavement, and then, nodding his chin, simply says,
"Go! Go!"
You move towards the gate to join the other refugees and are quickly brought into the large bunker. You take your place in a lineup against the wall with the other people from the truck. An officer approaches each one to examine their papers and baggage. He comes to you first.
After a moment of flipping through the pages of your passport, he gives you a stern look and calls over to the other officer. He shows him one of the pages and whispers something to him and then sends him out of the room.
"You were in Malta," he says.
You are not sure if this is a question, so you do not respond.
"How you say in English, out of the pan into the flames," he chuckles grimly.
"Something like that," you reply.
He snaps the papers back at you. "We are running out of places to go, I'm afraid."
He goes on to look at Mohammed's Maltese papers and gives another muted chuckle.
"Stay out of trouble, gentlemen. If you have somewhere to go, go there now. If not, report to the holding center."
You are let out of the bunker into the Carthagische Schutzgebäude. The streets are completely dark, except for those occasionally lit up by patrols of armored vehicles trawling through the neighborhood. Mohammed seems to know where to go, so you travel by the light of the moon, following his silhouette, keeping close to the walls. Every so often you are blinded by the headlights of a patrol vehicle, and you have to stop a moment to adjust to the light. After some time, you come to an alleyway. He indicates to you to hold on to the back of his collar, and you plunge yourself blindly into a dark passageway. You hear the creaking of a doorway, and then some low voices, and when your eyes finally see light again, you find yourself in a dimly lit room. It appears to be the cellar of a building. At one end, there are two men and a woman dressed in a sweater and pants with red scarves, and they're huddled over a table. Others are sitting around on the floor against the walls. As your eyes adjust to the light, you see a familiar face standing before you. It is the bald man who had questioned you during your last visit to African Tunis and greets you warmly.
"My friend, welcome back. I remember now, I did not introduce myself to you the last time we met. Please, call me Stotsas. Welcome to the revolution."
Mohammed has already gone over to the table and is shaking hands with the huddle.
"Thank you for delivering our comrade," he says. "He is very important to our cause."
He motions you to another room with benches and bunks where some of the men are eating.
"You must be tired," he says. "You have had a great adventure. A real hero of the people."
The men all give you a cheer and invite you to join them. One of the men quickly gets up to greet you. He speaks with an American accent and is very animated.
"When I heard there was another American here, I came right over."
A little taken aback, you respond.
I'm Canadian, actually.
Joseph Berg," he introduces himself.
"Grew up in New York, but I've been living in Russia the last few years."
He slips into the narrow bench beside you.
"They got me working at the local power concern here in Tunis,"
he says in a sly voice.
"If those Germans only knew I was working for the Soviets, they'd have me shot up against a post, believe me."
He stops himself from saying any more.
"How did you end up working for the revolution? Don't think we have any Canadians in the brigade."
"I actually got caught up in it by accident, really," you reply. "It all started with a case of mistaken identity." And before you can go on, he slaps you on the shoulder.
"Anyway, we're all part of the same nation here, right?"
He points his finger around the room.
"You got men and women from all over here. Look, even some Germans."
"I know, right? Strange bedfellows." He pulls out a copy of the Times and plops it on the table.
"Pick this up today at the power plant."
He spreads it out like a parchment.
"Yesterday's edition. Can you believe that they flew this in on one of those relief planes?"
The headline reads, "Luftwaffe maintains lifeline to Fortress Africa." And then below it, "Eastern Med blockade continues. Refugees flee to Algeria and Libya."
"The Russian plan is working," he announces proudly. "They've blocked the Suez, and now they control the waters around Malta."
He opens the paper to another page with a large map.
"And the Italian fleet, for what it's worth, is stuck in the Adriatic, busy fighting Slavic partisans. German Carthage is all alone. And here we are, right in the belly of the beast."
One of the men comes in with a pot of stew and some flatbread, and the men and women all squeeze as best they can around the table. The conversation jumps from story to story, sharing battle tales from the past few days of fighting and missions that they'd like to carry out. Berg and a couple of men talk in a low voice about coordinating an attack to be carried out in the morning.
You'll be part of this one, too, he says to you. Tomorrow we're flipping the switch on these bastards. They won't know what hit them.
After the meal, you are offered a cot to sleep on and some very basic washing facilities. And overcome with exhaustion, you take it and finally rest your tired body. Your eyes close and your mind wanders to the sound of the printing press in the next room. And soon enough, you are in deep sleep. You're woken to a hand on your mouth, and a man telling you to be quiet.
Not move,
he whispers.
Soldiers coming.
You look around the room, and everyone is standing motionless in silence. There's a creaking and shuffling sound going on upstairs. The men's eyes follow the footsteps back and forth, listening to the muffled voices in German. At one point, one of the voices is directly above you. One of the men, clutching his assault rifle, slowly raises his weapon, but the man next to him calmly restrains him. Eventually, the noise dies down, and the men go back to their work. Some of them are cleaning their weapons. Others are busy packing red and black leaflets. Some more are just resting. Stotzas enters the room.
Comrade, you are awake.
He pulls you aside. We had a visit this morning, but they are gone now. You follow him through a passageway.
Come with me to the roof.
A narrow stairwell leads to a fourth-floor rooftop overlooking the city. You are careful not to get too close to the edge. In the distance, you can make out the harbor where you left some days ago and the government building where you had been brought for interrogation. You are suddenly interrupted by a low-flying aircraft passing directly above you and descending towards an airstrip inside the city.
Blumenwasser 144,
says Stutzass, beholding the aircraft as if it were his own.
They fly one in and out of this city every 27 minutes. And, of course, being German, you can set your clock to it.
The propeller sound drifts off and is followed by an eerie echo. And from the direction of African Tunis comes the sound of scores of loudspeakers pumping music over the din of the city. You recognize it as the Internationale, the anthem of communism.
Listen, listen,
says Stotzas, smiling. And on comes a message.
Attention, workers! The day of liberation has come! Germans, French, Italians, you are all Africans. The rule of kings, emperors, and gangsters is over. Choose freedom.
The time to strike is now, says Stotzas gravely. We need you for one more mission.
He hands you a small parcel the size of a brick.
You must deliver this package to the government building. Over there. You remember where you met the commandant.
He puts his hand firmly on your shoulder.
It is a very important message.
You weigh the package nervously in your hands.
If you ask for a meeting with the commandant, he smiles,
I'm sure he will speak with you.
Then you can give him this.
He sees the alarm on your face.
You are not in danger,
he says reassuringly.
When you do this, you are free to go. We ask you for no more.
He points to the government building in the distance.
It is simple. You start walking. You go to the building. You ask for the commandant. You give him the package. You go home.
You put the package carefully into your satchel, and Stotzas brings you downstairs again. A section of the wall has been painstakingly moved to make an exit through the long makeshift tunnel. And as you are ushered out, the men give you a raised fist of solidarity. Power to the people, they call out. Moments later, you are walking the streets again. You have no idea where you are, so you make your way in the general direction of the government building. The city streets seem to be running as usual, fewer cars driving, but people are still going about their business. And you notice a lot of lineups outside grocery stores awaiting rations and people being checked as they go into buildings. Some buildings are boarded up, others not. Every second corner is set up with a sandbagged enclosure and barbed wire, and soldiers in German uniforms holding their posts. And as you make your way down the avenues, you can't help but notice a figure pacing about a block behind you. You stop for a moment to tie your shoe, and you notice that he stops too. And then, as you move again, so does he. You come upon Belisariusplatz, where the main administrative buildings are found. As you turn a corner, you suddenly come face to face with two patrol guards. Halt! Says one of them. Wohin gehen Sie? It's too late to turn around, and you find yourself clutching your bag nervously. Ausweis bitte! You hand him your passport, and he looks through it suspiciously. He points to your bag. Was hast du in der Tasche? Show me your bag, please. The other guard reaches to take the bag off your shoulder. Es ist in Ordnung, says a voice suddenly from behind you. Es mit mir. You turn around and see the unmistakable face of John Stockwell. He flashes his identification to the guards, who immediately relent. Ich werde es von hier nehmen, danke. Stockwell salutes them lazily, and they return the salute as they continue on their way. As soon as they are gone, I could have sworn I saw you leaving here on a ship, he says cheerily. It's not that easy to get rid of you, is it? He gently puts the bag on his own shoulder and, lighting a cigarette, nods his head to the main street. Somebody wants to meet you. You walk across the square to a hotel. The square is built up like a fortress, with tank traps and barricades and barbed wire and guards. Stockwell flips his ID so it hangs from his breast pocket, and moving swiftly past the guards to the entrance, you stride into the lobby of the Ben Gassim Hotel. It is a hive of activity. Journalists, diplomats, and military personnel standing around. Stockwell passes two American officers in uniform with their ranks covered up. They salute him firmly, to which he vaguely salutes them in return. The hotel is done up in an Ottoman style, with luscious rugs and ornate tile work. You step into a creaky cast-iron elevator, and with a squeak and a thud, the doors roll open, and you are greeted by an older man in a ridiculous, ornate uniform wearing a fez. The elevator has a lush interior with a velvet bench and mirrored walls, dulled since the colonial era in which they were installed. The cage clangs to a halt at the roof terrace, and there is a bistro at the top, with a few small groups having drinks. The entire perimeter is protected by a wall of sandbags, but the guests sit relaxed around ornate wrought iron tables and chairs. You follow him to a corner table. Meet Larry Devlin from the American Embassy. The table is piled with papers, and there's an ashtray heaped with cigarette butts. And a man in horn-rimmed glasses and short-sleeved dress shirt is speaking French on the phone. He finishes his call as you stand there and finally hangs up the phone, pointing to the chair across from him. As you sit down, a waiter comes by to scoop up the ashtray and plops down a fresh one. John here says you can't get enough of this place, says Devlin, putting out his cigarette. I must admit, it's beautiful this time of year. You are now sitting across from Devlin and Stockwell. You notice immediately that they both have on the same white short-sleeve shirt and the same short, cropped military haircut. Only Stockwell is wearing sunglasses. I'm not even going to ask what on earth brought you back to this hellhole. Considering you had a perfectly good way out, he chuckles. That's your business. Stockwell hands him your bag. You know, I gotta say, of all the assets we've worked with, you are one of my favorites. He opens the bag and takes out the parcel. You brace yourself at the sight of the ghastly thing, and every impulse in your body says to run for your life as he inspects it. I honestly get the feeling that you have no idea what's going on. He sees the alarmed look on your face and starts to open the package. And then he stops, and the two men look at each other. Boom! Says Stockwell, and they both start laughing. Inside the package is a stack of leaflets. Devlin hands one of them to you. There's an image of a snake entwined around Africa, squeezing out the oil, and patches along the back of the creature that are vaguely shaped like swastikas and the American flag. And across the top is written, "Join the people's struggle." Did you think you were the bomb guy? He says flatly. You are not the bomb guy. You're the messenger guy, says Stockwell. You're the guy they use to bring in the bomb guy. This guy, says Devlin, holding up a picture of Muhammad. This is the guy who knows what's going on. You probably know him as Muhammad, says Stockwell. He goes by a lot of names. We know him as Redbeard. He's Georgian originally. KGB operative. And your other friend. He pulls out another picture. Oh, that's Stotsaz, you say, recognizing the bald man in the photo. Stotsaz. Yeah, I like that. The man knows his history. He drops the photos back into the folder and gently flaps it shut. The Ruskies don't just want to liberate the working people. You see, they need a foothold in Africa. Corner the oil flow. So they're sending in some of their best operatives. Last time we saw this guy, he was in Vietnam. And now he's come ashore to coordinate a naval landing here in German Africa. Did your friend Mohammed say anything to you when you were transporting him? Mohammed, you reply. No, he's mute. He doesn't speak. The two men crack up in laughter. Oh, that's a good one. The guy speaks five languages. He's former special forces, paratrooper during the war. The man is a cold-blooded killer. I'm surprised he didn't leave you dead, buried in the desert. He seemed like a nice guy, you reply. Oh, I'm sure he is. Just like me, says Devlin. He hands you back your bag, leaving the open package on the table. I wish we could do better with these commies, but they've got us where they want us. He lights up another cigarette while the other one is still burning in the ashtray. Some days I wish we were still fighting the Nazis. You know, it was simpler back then. But that's what you get for disarming Europe's most powerful army. And now we got to deal with the real Huns. Now, nobody's got an army to fight these guys. So, the war's got to be fought by guys like us. They're playing chess while we're playing Parcheesi, interjects Stockwell. The good news, kid, says Devlin, is that they're letting you go. The fact that they didn't kill you means they like you, interjects Stockwell again. They think you're harmless. And so do we, says Devlin. You've been through a lot. And it's time to let you go for good. For real this time, says Stockwell. We're closing your file, says Devlin. Uncle Sam would give you a medal, but you don't exist. He shows you a document with your picture stapled to some pages of information, and he lights it up and lets it smolder in the bin next to him. John here will get you some transport to Sicily. And the two men exchange a glance. As long as you promise never to come back. Just then, the phone rings next to him. If you'll excuse me. Devlin is immediately absorbed in his phone call, and Stockwell stands up to usher you back to the elevator. You take the laborious contraption back down to the lobby, and then without ceremony you are led to a sedan parked at the curb outside the hotel. And on your way through the streets of the European sector to the airstrip, you see a growing crowd of people at the main entrance trying desperately to flee the city. "Those folks out there would kill to get on this plane," he says loudly. "But we got a war to fight." As the soldiers flag your vehicle through the gates, you feel a wave of relief pass over you. The turmoil of Africa is slowly drifting into the dust behind you. "Take a last look," says Stockwell grimly. "The end of an era." A German transport plane is sitting ready at the foot of the runway. You join a short line of men and women, mostly European, some in military uniform, boarding the rear entrance. And Stockwell watches, leaning on the hood of his car, as you climb aboard. He's still there as the aircraft taxis down the runway for takeoff, and as you lift off into the sky, you watch poor Carthage await its fate as it creeps into the past, giving way to the vast blue sea. The plane roars into the atmosphere, and you can see the specks of Russian warships below. And as you try to relax in your seat, remembering in a flash the violent impact from your last flight. But you needn't worry. Your journey has come to an end. Your time is up on this adventure. And not a moment too soon, since, as you heard yourself, colonial Africa is about to be turned upside down. The world that awaits on the other side of the Mediterranean, we'll have to wait for another adventure, another day. Let Europe face its destiny alone. There are other worlds to explore, other times to exist, other people to be. So sit back and let Fortress Africa fall away.
Thus ends Fortress Africa by Tristan Verboven. What a great show. I love the world Tristan created here, and the production values were just incredible. Just putting the plot aside for a moment, the thing I'm beginning to really love about Tristan's work is his worldscaping. He creates such a vivid picture in the mind. I mean, I'm not sure if he actually even mentioned the crumbling plaster on the old colonial buildings, but I distinctly remember seeing them when I was listening to his story. Lots of people out there can write. A smaller number can edit sounds and music. A handful of people can really tell great stories with their voice. But a tiny, tiny number of people have all three of those qualities, and Tristan has them in spades. That's why I really feel our podcasters need to be paid for their efforts. These guys are so talented, and they've put so much effort into honing their craft. And honestly, the amount of time it takes to create these shows is immense. I mean, it absorbs your entire mind while you're doing it. They need an income from this, especially during a time of uncertainty when they're all facing hardships. And that's why I'm so appreciative of our Patreon community. Our patrons support these incredible artists. Kevin Valbenesi and I were chatting about it, and it struck us that if the multiverse is infinite, then so too are the possibilities. Surely there could be other worlds with exotic laws of physics, or even magic. So to flex the imagination, Kevin created a show that breaks the laws, so to speak. In his story, available to patrons, you are a conquistador exploring the jungles of the new world. Something has been destroying the golden cities. Something ancient. Listen to The Pale God by Kevin Valbenesi, only on Patreon. Visit twilighthistories.com and follow the link. I hope you and your family are safe in these troubled times. I'm Jordan Harbour. Till next time, take care.
In your brief time here in the jungles of the Yucatan, you have made but one profound discovery. The mightiest nation in the New World is neither the Maya, nor the Aztecs, nor the Inca. It is that of the mosquito. The little black-winged devils swarm about in numbers so vast as to momentarily obscure the light of the sun. And when one of these bloodthirsty clouds descends upon anyone, it is worse than being struck by one of Jove's lightning bolts. Such misery is your lot, and it makes it nigh impossible to appreciate the majesty of where you and the adventurous Spaniards have made camp. All around you, the ruins of a Mayan city stretch out, partially swallowed by the jungle, but still open enough that every pocket of Spanish tents remains visible. You stand with a few Spaniards in what must have been a temple, admiring the bas-reliefs and the glyphs which line the walls. This temple rests at the top of a squat step pyramid, and it's not the largest structure in the complex. That would be the palace. And it's fitting that there is only one tent set up within the walls of the palace. Where you stand, you can make out the captain of the expedition, a grizzly bear of a man named Hector Velasquez. He, like everyone else, swats the mosquitoes while attempting to go about his business, inspecting an arquebus in this case. Velasquez, despite the relentless pestering of the mosquitoes, takes his time with his weapon, cleaning it out, checking the supply of gunpowder, wadding, and bullets. The Spaniards in the temple busy themselves with dice, bouncing them off the bas-relief of a Mayan king and his high priests. Unable to tolerate the utter disregard for the ruins, you grab your arquebus and sword and step out of the temple, descending the staircase toward the main winding path through the city. You pass under large trees and step over toppled stones as you navigate the path, doing your best to ignore the dozens of bugs assaulting you at any given moment. You are glad for the trousers, shirt, and leather jacket which you're currently wearing, for the heavy-plated armor worn back in Europe would have cooked you in the tropical heat. You pull the wide-brimmed hat from your head and fan your face, trying to stay cool and drive away the insects all at once. After a minute or two, you arrive at the wide-open ball court where captives would have played against the rulers of the city, forfeiting their lives if and when they lost the game. You eye the loop through which one would cast their shot, and you imagine yourself launching a ball through it to the amazement of the gathered crowd. But there is only silence here. Silence, and a young man. He is the only other stranger among the Spaniards, with his dark skin, aquiline nose, and prominent cheekbones proudly proclaiming his Mayan heritage. He's dressed in pants and a shirt, but the clothes are an ill fit, and he looks ready to tear them off. As you approach the young man, who was introduced to you as Beco,